It's 125 years. They commenced building in 1886. There'd been a smaller church on that site, but the town outgrew it, and there was a need to provide for a bigger congregation. And so and then that coincided with a decision to split off Gippsland, this vast area, from Melbourne and form its own diocese. So when the decision was made to rebuild, they had an eye to the needs for a future cathedral. So although there wasn't any Bishop of Sale appointed, there was they anticipated that. So it was built so that it could be adapted to that purpose.
With those decisions running concurrently, that we're going to build the cathedral and branch out as a separate diocese, or did one come before the other?
No, they were concurrent, really, and although they're not known generally by the laity or by people in Gippsland, but but it was concurrent.
Mm. And was there always the thought that there would be a bishop sent from Sale, sent from Melbourne out to Sale to run this new diocese?
Yes. I'm not absolutely certain about that, but the first bishop was a Bishop Corbett, and he was the pastor of East St Kilda, and he'd been heavily involved in education matters in the Archdiocese, or in the Melbourne Diocese, and obviously a very capable man, and he was selected to be the first Bishop of Sale. He was an Irishman, as the first three bishops were Irish, but he was also a Francophile. He'd attended school in France, and he had been ordained. He'd attended a seminary at Le Mans, so he had this connection with French culture as well as his own Irish culture. And when he arrives, shortly after he arrives, he returns to Europe and to France and recruits the Sisters of Our Lady of Sion, French Order Notre Dame de Sion, and their beautiful building is just across the road from the studio.
Mm.
So that was the first bishop.
I've always wondered what the link was. Well, the Josephite nuns had a very strong strong history through Gippsland, and there are Brigidine nuns as well. There's quite a few orders. I was wondering how a French order could be brought into it, and here it is.
That's right.
Thanks to Bishop Corbett.
That's Bishop Corbett, and I think it's because of this French connection, although I know one of his main aims was to establish a girls' school. It wasn't just only for Catholic girls, but it was for young women to provide secondary education. The only other prospect for education for girls at that time was to leave Gippsland and go to Melbourne. Mm. So this was to provide for this gap in education for girls. Bishop Corbett went to various countries recruiting and... but it was in France that he received a very warm welcome, and the Sion sisters said yes, they had the numbers to staff a school in the wilderness of Gippsland. They never ever heard of it before, but there you are.
They turned up nonetheless.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness me. Now, the other interesting thing was originally the bells in the belfry were from France as well.
Yes, that's right. Yes, and the foundry... was in Le Mans. This is where Bishop Corbett was ordained, where he attended the seminary, and he would have known of that bell. He would have known of that industry there, bell making industry. So he originally, when the church was designed, it was designed for a bell tower attached to the church. Gippsland was relatively poor. The Catholics were mainly working class, there was not a great deal of wealth about. And when the plans and specifications came in, or the tenders came in, the money wasn't there. So the bell tower was scrapped. But then Corbett believed that it was very important to have church bells as part of the liturgy. So he arranged for a freestanding belfry, which was designed a couple of years later. Then he sent to Le Mans for a peal of bells, three bells. And they were cast at a foundry there, And that foundry is still going today. It's in the eighth generation of bell makers.
Gee.
Still there today. Beautiful bells, beautiful bells.
Are those bells that he brought here, are they still in existence somewhere?
Yes, they're there. They're still in the belfry. They're the same ones. One of them, the largest one, the deepest bell, developed a crack about 1915, mm-hmm. long time ago,
mm-hmm.
and it was silent for 20 years. The then bishop was a Bishop Phelan, another Irish bishop, and his main priority at that time was to build a school, secondary school for boys, a boarding school, which was St. Patrick's College, became St. Patrick's College. So all his resources and all his personal wealth went into the building of that St. Pat's College. And he wasn't prepared. He inquired about repairing the bell. And the answer from the foundry was, yes, we can repair it, but send it over and we'll melt it down and recast it.
Oh.
And that was very, very big money. And he didn't think it was warranted at that time. But it's a terrific story, this one, Celine. In 1935, there was a local foundry in Sale. It was here for over 100 years. It was called Lacey's. It's in York Street, not far from here, not far from the studio. And in 1935, a new form of welding had come in and was using electrodes. I think it's called arc welding, but I stand to be corrected. And Lacey's said, yeah, we think we can repair that crack. And not destroy the sound, not impair the sound, so they said no guarantee, but let us try, and it's been an amazing success. They repaired it, arc welding, and rehung it, and it's been going ever since.
Isn't that terrific?
Yeah.
The photos in this book are absolutely terrific. Did they come from parish records, or did you just have to go around to parishioners, find out who might have had some of these photos? Because it's not just the old ones as well. It's some of them, the more modern ones. And flick on the one that your lovely wife Anne took.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes, Anne took some of the loveliest photographs there. We also had other photographers. Charles Quirk was a noted photographer. We asked parishioners if they could look through their cupboards and if they had any photographs. There's also some libraries of photographs. The Sale Museum had a good collection, as did the diocesan collection. So we drew on all those, and we had a wealth of photographs in the end, and it was difficult selecting from them, Celine.
I'm also reading a little bit about the carpet in the cathedral. And I've never noticed there's actually a picture in the carpet, a sandal.
That's right, yes. Yeah. In the cathedral.
I just thought it was red carpet with lovely little patterns.
No, there's symbols in all of that. And the particular symbol of the sandal relates to a lovely icon which arrived Bishop Corbett brought it back from Rome in 1890. And it's an icon to Our Lady of Perpetual Help. And she is holding the Christ child, and the sandal is falling off his feet. And it is thought, I don't know how orthodox this view is, but it is thought that he was having a premonition of his own death.
Oh.
And so that sandal motif has been picked up in the carpet. And that particular carpet relates to the redevelopment of the church under Bishop Coffey, Bishop Emeritus Coffey's time, 1992-1993, when there was a big refurbishment and those lovely additions were made.
Yeah, how fascinating. What's the wow factor for you?
I think, Celine, that the wow factor to me is that although the cathedral is large and big and a very noble edifice, it has a wealth of artwork, sculptures, and Stations of the Cross. With all of that, it still retains its prayerfulness. I think that's quite remarkable. It still has that milieu, even though it is this beautiful building, architect design, Gothic Revival, lofty, beautiful spaces, but it still retains that prayerfulness. And I think that's the great achievement of it. There's a softness about it, I think.
Mm-hmm. When does a church become a cathedral?
It becomes a cathedral when a diocese is formed. As soon as Bishop Corbett took up his post in 1887, it automatically became a cathedral. The bishop's seat or chair is a cathedra in Latin, so hence the word cathedral. So that's also a symbolic mark that it's the principal church of the diocese, the mother church of the diocese.
Yeah, because you can have some churches that are quite large venues, but and I think, oh, well, why don't they call this a cathedral? And that's really because of the bishop's chair.
Yes, that's right. Other magnificent aspects of it is I alluded to the artwork. There's a beautiful sculpture of Mary MacKillop, Blessed Mary MacKillop, relates to the time that she became Blessed Mary MacKillop, about 1995, and the design was by Annemieke Meehan, who resides in Sale but is an artist of international repute. That is a magnificent sculpture, attracts a lot of attention.
And there's a MacKillop relic as part of that, isn't it?
There is, embedded in resin, and Dr. Philip Meehan undertook that task. It's a piece of the coffin from Mary MacKillop's coffin. She died in Brunswick, Melbourne, but then was reinterred in North Sydney. This relic is from the original coffin.
Gee. Mm. Well, plenty of things to have a look at. If you have never stopped by the cathedral, and it doesn't matter if you're not religious in any way, from a historical perspective, there is plenty there to have a look at, from an artistic perspective, from an architectural perspective as well. And if you would like to find out further information about it, find out what all the little bits and bobs are and how it all came to be, Three Springtimes is the book by Peter Synam.